Coach, are you still hanging on to that old shooting machine that's just sitting in storage and not getting used at all? Our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are here to help trade in your machine. Any make, any model, in any condition, even if it's from a competitor. Plus, you get an extra $250 off the Dr. Dish commercial lineup when you mention Rising Coaches.
I would tell myself or other coaches, have big goals and have big dreams. They don't happen overnight. Don't set a bar too low for yourself. Don't cap your ceiling.
On this episode of the Rising Coaches podcast, we're joined by Brett McConnell, head coach at Dartmouth College. Coach McConnell has built an impressive career through assistant coaching stops at Rutgers, Delaware Valley, Holy Family, St. Peter's, Princeton, and Stanford before earning the opportunity to lead the Dartmouth program. His experience at both the mid-major and high-major levels have given him a unique perspective on leadership, recruiting, and building successful programs. In this episode, we discuss the biggest lessons he learned as an assistant that now shape his approach as a head coach, the challenge of identifying players who truly fit both the program's culture and academic standards, and the key priorities he focused on during his first 60 days leading an Ivy League program.
Welcome back, coaches. Everybody, thank you all for tuning in to another episode of the Rising Coaches podcast. Alan Major, Doug Caputo here. We are excited to talk some hoops. Chop it up with the head coach, Dartmouth College, ladies and gentlemen, Brett McConnell. Coach McConnell, Welcome.
New head
What's
coach.
What's up, Doug?
New head coach.
Yeah.
I'm even still getting used to hearing all that. It sounds good, Doug. Thanks,
sparkling,
man.
Sparkling new, man. You're undefeated, brother. Enjoy it.
I know. These Coach Smith, my boss at Stanford, told me, you're going to love the first 6 months before you play a game. So I've been enjoying it so far. I know that's going to change at some point. So we're enjoying it while we can.
There you go. I'm happy for you, brother.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
No, of course. I'm sure it's an exciting time. Like you said, the first 6 months, and once the games start, then things probably start to pick up and it gets a little bit more difficult. But we're excited to be able to get you on here, talk your journey. And really, before even getting into the Ivy League level, you spent years growing in different basketball environments, learning the profession from the ground up. Looking back now, what parts of those early years, the experiences, what really helped influence you in your style that you feel? Now, I understand you haven't had a full season or a season yet, but what type of things have helped you or influenced you from your early years?
Yeah, it's funny because as you frame that question, I start to think about my start, and I think about first being a manager at Rutgers and the grittiness, the grind, the work ethic, the humility. A lot of us as managers were high school athletes, and we were used to being the ones on the court, and then you end up wiping up sweat and filling up the water jugs and doing some of the not so glamorous stuff. And at the time, I didn't love it. But it was really good for my development and learning how to roll my sleeves up and that there was no job too small or too big and being ready to grind through this profession, which is not easy at any spot, at any level, at any position. It's not easy. I think I gained a lot from that and also had an insight into at the time, Big East program at Rutgers. So a really high level program, two different head coaches, two very different styles, a Midwesterner and Gary Waters, and then a Jersey guy and Fred Hill. And so that was the real start for me. But a turning point or sort of a fork in the road came when I graduated college. And first of all, you realize how difficult it is to break in. So you have these ideas. You're like, I'm in a Big East program. I'm the head manager. I'm doing all this stuff for the coaches. They're going to get me a job. And it's not that easy. Not that easy to get a job. I thought I was going to stay in Division I. I thought I was going to have a nice Division I job, maybe video coordinator, maybe ops, something like that. And at the end of the day, two opportunities presented themselves. And I don't even know if one of them I would be offered the job, but I at least interviewed at LIU Brooklyn. It was LIU Brooklyn at the time. For their op spot was also their GA spot. Not a very well supported staff. So the ops was the GA. And maybe a little bit, I didn't want to go back to school. But also the role was going to require me to do a lot of the stuff that was a little bit closer to being a manager. And still a little bit further from being a coach. And I went through that interview process. Again, I'm not sure if I would have been offered the job, but the other thing that I looked at, actually another manager at Rutgers was like, hey, my buddy plays Division III. He's at Delaware Valley College. They just got a new head coach. I picked up the phone. By the way, I actually have an office phone here. I picked up the phone at the office. I called the office number. I just went online and called the office number at Delaware Valley College, a guy named Casey Stitzel, who I knew nothing about. I looked at his bio very quickly. And I was like, hey, I'm a manager at Rutgers. I'm looking for a job. He's like, why don't you come interview with me at Delvin down here next week? I'm like, great. And I had a great interview. He offered me a job on the spot. I left the interview. I called my dad. My dad works in athletics. My dad actually worked at Rutgers at the time. He works at Rutgers now. And I was like, Dad, I got offered the job. He's like, what does it pay? I said, $2,000. He said, per month? I said, that's for the year, Dad. But to be able to recruit and coach and get that experience, I just felt like it's what I needed coming off of being a manager. Also, you're going to work, and I think I want to do this my whole life. I need to coach and recruit and know that's what I want to do. That's the path I want to follow. And I got such great experience. I recruited just about the whole roster the 2 years I was there. I did every single scouting report for 2 seasons. It was the best way to start my career. And that path isn't for everybody, and it's really hard. Everybody was telling me, hey, if you go to D3, it's really hard to get to Division I. And I don't know the numbers, and I know there's no easy path in this business. But I do tell up-and-coming coaches, this worked for me. And you got to find what's best for you. But I could not have had a better start to my career, a better path to gain experience. And also, your recruiting network, like, there were no dead periods. And Division III had no recruiting calendar, right?
Like, no.
Doug, you know that. Unfortunately, you know that, Doug.
No rules.
So I got to be out all the time. I would work a camp. I would work a tournament. I would work an AAU event. And it would be a little bit recruiting, a little bit networking. Also evaluating guys for different levels. And was just really good experience for me. That's maybe not initially what I thought when I thought about your question. But as you phrased it, that was the best thing for me.
Yeah. Now, the deep end, as frightening as it can be, I know it's not wise to skip steps when you're taking swimming lessons, but in our business, sometimes you don't have the benefit of that development. So yeah, you just got thrown into the deep end right away, exactly. Which is great. Exactly. But who along the way inspired you to want to be a coach? Was it your high school coach? Was it multiple people, the way you were coached when you were younger? I always like to ask this question because one, it gives you a little gratitude when you think about the answer.
Yeah.
Like, man, thank God for this person that spoke to me or spoke this into me.
Yeah.
And then it also just allows for a little bit of reflection because it really helps you look in your own rearview mirror as you look at your own life. So who was that person for you? And then when did that, was there a moment or was it a progression of them talking to you about it? How did that play out?
And we talked a little bit earlier, Alan, and both my parents just been so influential in me being in this position, first of all, and so grateful for their support. And at a young age, both sports lovers and guided me into athletics, which was so important for my development. But my dad in particular, I mentioned he worked at Rutgers. He was in a lot of different roles, but essentially assistant athletic director for my whole childhood. And so I would be at every sporting event there was at Rutgers growing up. And the basketball games captivated me, and the strategy and the personalities and the connection between the player and coach and those relationships. So I did know at a pretty young age that I wanted to coach and saw different styles. Again, at a really young age, I was pretty aware of the different styles of coaches that I had in all the different sports. And just early on knew that it was something that I wanted to pursue and didn't exactly know how I was going to pursue it or how it would fall into place. But I knew early on that it was definitely something that I wanted to pursue. And I actually just got a message from somebody. It's been really cool getting different outreach from different people when you get a head position. But a buddy of mine that we went to middle school together sent me a message on Instagram. He was like, I remember at your locker in eighth grade, it was like we were getting ready for March Madness and you said you wanted to be a head college basketball coach. And I do think I was fortunate that I knew at an early age that it was something I wanted to do, and I've never lost focus of that.
Nah, it's 13 years old for me. It's too long a story to tell, but it was like one of those moments where I don't ever want to be away from this ever.
Yeah.
And so you just kind of know that, but that's cool, man. Yeah. Yeah. And Gary Waters, a Rising Coaches podcast alum, believe it or not.
There we go.
Once again, the basketball world shrinks a little bit.
It's really cool.
No, and I'm sure, to your point, I'm sure it's a blessing and a curse to be able to hear from people you haven't heard from, because it's a blessing. You get to hear these stories, these things that pop up, but then I feel, and as May just told me before, a lot of people start to come out of the woodworks that maybe you haven't heard from in a while. So that's probably a little more unique.
Yeah. It probably depends. You get it both ways, Brett. It's,
yeah,
they're either well-wishing or they're asking.
Yeah.
So if they're well-wishing, that's great. Sometimes if they're asking, it's, I know we met at an AAU tournament 7 years ago, but nice to hear from you. But yeah. I think I'm good. I think I know what I'm doing staff-wise. But thanks for reaching out anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know, maybe I'm like glass half full, or maybe I was really nervous about what that would be like, because I got much more, yeah, much more well-wishing than, yeah, awesome. There was definitely some, but the well-wishes outweighed everything else. I'm grateful for that too.
Wait till you end up at St. John's after Dartmouth, then that'll probably change a little bit.
Yeah, so that could be scary.
No, and the thing that I really like to share, and I know you touched on it too, is you've grown in the industry. I feel like that's the one thing. There's two things that really stand out to me of what you said. And one is, you knew at a young age that you wanted to get into this profession. And I feel like a lot of times people have told us they did not have the intentions and it just got them into it. So that's unique. But I feel like now I feel it's probably 50-50 in this profession. But then also, having to step back into a Division III role to then work your way up to at Division II, ACC, Ivy League, and obviously being a head coach now, that's something that I think a lot of people overlook, is that you sometimes do have to step back. And I don't want to speak on it because I've been at the Division III this whole time, but all the people that we have had on these podcasts and talked with, you could see that they have progressed and grown. And it's definitely, it's cool, but it's unique.
Yeah. Doug, I grew a ton. And the quote unquote level allowed me to get greater experience than I might have at Division I. But, and I hired a former longtime Division III head coach on my staff. And the basketball is the basketball. So anybody who wants to be like, yeah, oh, you grew because you went from D3 to D2 or D1, there are plenty of D3 coaches that are head coaches right now that know 20 times what I know as a Division I head coach. And I'm sure there's people from all different levels listening to this podcast. My growth came because I got an opportunity to get great experience, but the level I think is irrelevant. And even just from being at Stanford last year, which was an awesome experience, and hopefully we get to talk about that, and Coach Smith, who was incredible, but Ivy League to ACC, the charter flights were nice. The meals were awesome. The gear was incredible. The basketball is the basketball. And that level was not, I had plenty of great Princeton teams that would have been really good in the ACC last year. Yeah. And I'm sure we could say that about plenty of teams this year coming up. I don't know. Maybe that's the sensitivity because I've been in D3, but I had to stand up for my guys there.
I'm glad you said that, Brett. Here's an illustration. All right. Right now in Indianapolis, if you were to visit Indianapolis, and those that were here during the Final Four got a taste of it, there's a ridiculous amount of construction going on. It's almost like you can't drive a mile without seeing a detour sign. And so I say that in that sometimes in our profession, people think if Division I, Division II, if I go down a level, they think that's like a negative. It's painted as a negative. Sometimes going from Division I manager, GA, whatever it is, to Division III assistant, it's just a detour. It's not so much that it's a step back. It's just a detour. The detour is still going to get you where you want to go. It may not be a direct shot like you'd want it to, just like in traffic, right? You'd like for that. I want to be able to go here, the 3rd Street, make the left on Jackson Street, and then take me right to where I want to go. The detour says 3rd Street's not available right now. You got to go over to Williams Avenue, and then you got to go over here, and then you got to get to where you need to go. So I think our profession, as we continue to try to impact young coaches, look at it as detours as opposed to step backs, because step backs can almost paint it like it's a negative or maybe that's something that's not going to be productive. Detours can still be productive. It's just a different way of getting where you want to go.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's a great way to put it. And I know you mentioned Stanford. So I actually was at your game. And I wasn't even thinking about it until you said it. I was at your game last year when you played Pitt at Pitt.
Yeah. You mean at the ACC tournament?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. We had to bring that up, Doug.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring it up, but I was at your game. So it was my way of thinking, okay, I would have seen you beforehand.
That was, you know, this, yeah, that's, that speaks to the craziness of this profession, because that was my last time on the bench with those guys at Stanford. We chose to play in the Crown. The team went on spring break. I went recruiting on the East Coast for a week. I got the job, and Coach Smith basically was like, hey, if this was the NCAA tournament, I want you to come back, but you got to stay with your team at Dartmouth. So I didn't go to Vegas. I didn't go to the Crown. And so that ACC tournament loss was the last time I was on the bench with those guys. And I hadn't thought about it in a little while. Doug?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring up the light. It was more just the regards that I could have seen you or could have walked right past you and had no idea.
Well, it was a great game, first of all, for anybody who was just happened to watch some college basketball in March. And there was a lot, because we were on the bubble, there was a lot of bubble teams that were thrilled with that buzzer beater that Pitt put in. But what a really cool experience for me. The couple days before, we stayed in North Carolina because we had beaten NC State in an awesome game, in an awesome atmosphere. I got for example, Coach Abuka Okori for a year. He's going to be a first-round pick. It was just such a good experience for me in a lot of different ways. And I'm grateful to Coach Smith for that opportunity. Learned a ton from him.
Oh, awesome stuff, man. Just give us a really quick, under the hood, 2 minutes, Kyle Smith. Mm-hmm. What makes him – obviously, he sustained it at different levels. Yeah. Which that alone is a gift.
Yeah.
But what are some things that let's paint Kyle Smith back into your journey. What are some things that you learned from him, from him being a successful head coach that you're going to take with you?
He gets a lot of attention for nerdball, right? And being really right. Analytics guru, hustle stats, all those things, which are really cool and really awesome. And I was always drawn to the analytics. And I loved his approach to that. I loved his perspective in recruiting, the way we evaluated analytics and the stats of the guys on the circuit, the way he projected players and talked about usage. It was really good stuff. But I think better than that, and maybe it doesn't get talked about as much, his ability to connect with players and staff, to treat them with respect, to bring humility to that position, that leadership position that I don't think we always see. The humility or the ego get put aside, but to treat his players and staff really well without lowering the standards while still being disciplined, still coaching guys hard. But I thought that he got great effort from every single guy on the roster because of the respect that they had for him. And it was both hands working together. Pat on the back when you need it. And you know what? A little bit of the hard stuff too. And I just learned so much from that approach. And also, this would be a longer answer if I got to it, but I remember when I was young wondering if my authentic style could work, if my authentic style would be good enough. I hadn't been around a coach at this level that had my similar style. And I actually think Coach Smith and I are more similar in a lot of ways. And it was really good to see, hey, what I was doing as an assistant, for example, in relationship building, that could be successful from a head coach. The way he approached his players, his team, his staff, it was just great to see, hey, this works. This can work. And by the way, you can be a good guy. It can work being a good guy.
Right.
That's at the end of the day, that's what I think about Coach Smith, a really good person, a heck of a coach. And just even the way he treated my family and the families on staff, happy to have my son was in the locker room after a win or on the plane once in a while when we traveled. I'm just so grateful for the way he treated us. I just on the phone with him last night. He's asking how my family's doing. So really good guy, first of all.
Yeah. Now there's a novel idea, right? Like that you can be a good guy and you don't have to peel the paint off the walls. Again, some guys, that's their style. Some of them in our profession, very successful. We don't have to name them, but what you're saying there is you can't stray from being yourself.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's like that's the single biggest thing. As an assistant, you can't do it. But now being a head coach, you definitely can't do it. You've got to plant your feet in terms of being who you are. And that consistency of who you are is going to bleed into how you operate. It's going to bleed into how you handle your assistants. It's going to bleed into how you want to plan things. All right. So that consistency and that's a foundational deal that becomes like the anchors of your entire program and your players. Me and Doug, we talk about this all the time, and players just now more than ever, because of the input that players deal with, whether it be social or whatever it is, their antennas are as good as they've ever been.
Yeah, exactly.
So yes. they're gonna pick it off if you're not being yourself. So it just tells you that you got to double down on being who you are.
Absolutely. Yep.
So what kind of things do you feel like you're, and obviously being a genuine person, the relationship building you mentioned, but going into now your head coaching position at Dartmouth, what were some of the things that you look to bring in that you have learned from other coaches? Because I feel like you don't have to go through every stop and say everything unless you wish, but I feel like people usually take a thing or two that they have learned, maybe more, from a coach that they have worked for or worked with, and then they incorporate those into their own philosophies and their own way of doing things. What kind of things do you feel like you're bringing into Dartmouth?
Yeah. First of all, I think one small advantage I have is that I did work in the league for a long time. And so I'm going to try to steal things from every team in the league that's had success and try to blend some of the things that I've seen succeed in this league together. I also, 13 years at Princeton, gained a lot from that experience. Princeton has a long legacy, continuity within the basically Coach Carrill, his longtime assistant, Bill Carmody, and then all former Carrill and Carmody players have had that program. And we hear about the Princeton offense a lot. What I think about when I think of Princeton style is skill at every position, dribble, pass, shoot at every position. And I think there's a lot of different ways you can go with that. But ultimately, that's even before I got to Princeton, how I always saw the game and wanting bigger guys that could stretch the defense and space the court. And so Princeton was a perfect place for me to grow in that regard. And I'm working really hard with my guys now. There are guys that didn't shoot any threes that we're trying to help develop that outside game and become more skilled and just having every position be positionless and versatile.
No, I love it. I love it. For those of you listening, Brett and I met a few years ago. I actually interviewed with you guys for a spot there. And I just remember in some of our conversations, we even got into a couple of basketball mashups.
By the way, Alan, I'm gonna steal some of you had some good ideas on that call we had, and I'm gonna steal some of them. So
listen, man, that's if you want to reach back and chop it up, because we actually talked about the scrum action, right? Out of the break out of the delay where you hit your big, and instead of the guard just going to set the pin down into the DHO, is having the guard come and set a ball screen for the big. So an invert started with an inverted ball screen into a DHO.
Yep.
And then whatever you do with that guard, you can dive them or you could pop them as a shake or whatever it was. But obviously, that's a different rabbit hole for a different pod.
Yeah.
But I don't think Princeton in general, the style, Coach Carrill in particular, I don't think Princeton basketball has gotten nowhere near the credit for impacting the game the way it has, because you could just close your eyes and spin a globe in a social studies classroom and just put your finger on any country that it just happens to land on. And there's a bet that the Princeton style has impacted the style of play in that country.
No doubt. No doubt. Yeah, 100%.
It doesn't matter where. Just an amazing. That's the thing that's impressed me the most is that this style has bled into all levels, from the most basic youth levels all the way to NBA, FIBA, you name it.
Oh, you hear it all the time going to AAU tournaments, youth tournaments, even college now. There's a team in our conference that runs something similar, but you hear it all the time as people calling out a play, and it's whether they call it Princeton, which a lot of them do, or it's just Princeton style and they call it something different, but you see it all the time.
Yeah. My favorite thing since we are nerding out here for a little bit, it's made cutting cool again. There was a time where cutting really wasn't that cool of a thing in the game.
Yeah.
Right. And because Princeton obviously made it cool and Coach Carrill was there. All of a sudden, for those of you that don't know, Coach Carrill coached in the NBA with Sacramento Kings.
That's right.
Yes, Mike Bibby and Vlade Divac and Chris Webber and White Chocolate Jason Williams and Peja Stojakovic, and they start slicing people up. And now people are like, what in the world is this?
Yep.
And so, but cutting was such a part of that. And so the Princeton action actually made cutting cool. Now it's actually cool in any NBA game. It's cool to get a cut and score off of it.
You're right.
People actually chart the teams that lead the league in cut scoring off cuts.
Yes.
So that style, it's just been an amazing impact. I know I'm off the wall here talking about it, but it's really cool the impact that it's had.
No doubt.
Well, to circle back into things with you, so we mentioned what you were looking to bring into Dartmouth and just philosophy-wise, mentality-wise, but you were talking in the beginning, the first 6 months are fun, but nobody is aware of what happens in the first 6 months unless you have been in that seat. What were some of the things that, as soon as you get appointed head coach, you're like, all right, these are the priorities and the top things that I have to really tackle?
Number one, two, three, retain your roster. And you don't think about that as much as an Ivy League school, but I had a couple guys who were already in the portal when I got the job, and I was nervous there might be one or two more that were thinking about it. And I got an awesome core group coming back. And one thing that's unique about Dartmouth is we're on the quarter system terms, and our term actually yesterday was the last day that I could work with my team. So I went a lot later than most. May 28th is much later, so I did get a nice stretch of time to work with my returners this spring. And I think we built the foundation. But those early, really early days, retain the roster and then build a staff. And also, we took two transfers, which is unique for the Ivy League, unique for Dartmouth. We got two guys that are really good fits, not only for our program on the basketball side of things, but they fit academically, they fit the college, they fit Dartmouth. So that was a hustle. Transfers at a place that doesn't have NIL and where financial aid is need-based, not a basketball scholarship, not an easy thing to do. So credit to my staff. We hustled hard to get these two guys in. But those were the three biggest priorities: retain, recruit, and build a staff. I also love my staff. I hit a home run with my staff. Could probably elaborate another tangent I could go off on is to go through each of those guys. But I could not have picked a better staff, been fortunate to land these guys. So everything got easier when my staff was in place. And I think I spent a week or a week and a half on my own when I got the job. And then Eamon Carney and Amir Bell, both around that time. Amir was finishing with Stanford, and was the one positive of Stanford losing was that Amir could get out here. But when I got Amir and Eamon, that helped a lot. Then Bill Courtney, my ops guy, I was actually planning to do the ops spot last. And I was like telling Amir and Eamon, I was like, we can't go another day without an ops guy. So we're making this hire. And Bill's been awesome. And then Nick Nishay, who was a head coach at Franklin and Marshall for the last 7 years, actually was a manager with me at Rutgers, has joined my staff. And I just have a really well-rounded, great group of guys. And to have that full staff has made this, everything gets a little easier when you have people you trust that are around you and can support you.
Thank goodness for your D3 experience, though.
No doubt.
Because even though you're in a Division I level school, the concept is a D3 model.
100%.
So a lot of people don't realize that. They think Ivy League, they think scholarships and that you get 13 or 15 like everybody else. Not the case. Man, what an unbelievable runway you had leading up to this.
I know. Right? And I never would have guessed. I never would have guessed Del Val was going to take me to the Ivy League. But it was really great preparation. You're right.
Yeah, no question, man. Wow.
The fact that you were able to work with your guys up to a certain point. Once our guys' season is over, it's okay. We'll see you next year. And that's the one unfortunate thing. It's fortunate, but unfortunate, depending on how you look at it. You get time away, but then at the same point, you don't know what those guys are doing over the summer. So I'm sure being at that level is a little more different. But you mentioned about finding players. How difficult is it? Because this has always been on my mind. And honestly, once I found out, Mage told me, he's like, yeah, we got Coach McConnell coming on from Dartmouth. I'm like, I got to ask this. To find players, one that fit the academic standards, I'm sure is difficult in itself. Just that alone. Then you got to find people who fit your culture. And then you got to find people who also are good and fit the basketball portion too. You have to hit home runs on multiple aspects. How hard is that to identify those types of players?
It's not easy. I do think one thing that I've learned is you kind of got to cut to the chase on a lot of it. And first of all, bad body language, bad attitude, sniffing out something on the phone that feels selfish or that it doesn't align with your culture. Let's just cut our losses now. We don't need to try to guess when they show you that side. I'd rather say no and be like, you know what? Maybe it could have worked out than say yes and be like, that wasn't a fit and sort of regret what you have. So I'm really quick to the punch on that. Also really quick to try to get to the bottom of, we don't do anything until we get your transcripts. So that's gonna cross a lot of guys off. And then the financial aid and sort of the determining the fit for the school and the interest level, like I cut right to the chase on that too. Let's get the financial aid calculator to your parents. Let's make sure we know what we're getting into. Because the time, we have to recruit the whole country. In fact, we have to recruit the whole world at Dartmouth. And we can attract people because the Ivy League and the brand means a lot. But the pool would be too narrow if we didn't cast a wide net. And so if you're going to cast a wide net, you have to be efficient with how you're spending your time in recruiting. So, and I tell everybody, I'm from New Jersey. Yeah. So I'm a straight shooter anyway. Like I tell it like it is, whether you like it or not. And so we try to be really efficient and cut to the chase.
You know, what's great about that, though, those can be perceived as disadvantages. But the fact that you do have to get to that stuff right away, it's actually an advantage in a sense from the standpoint is that now I'm not saying it's easy. Yeah, I'm not saying it's easy. It's not easy. But it does allow you to cut through some things right from the jump.
100%.
By 30 minutes into that first phone call, you know that there's going to be a second phone call or not.
100%. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
So it actually ends up helping you in a sense. Yeah. And the fact that then you can cast a wide net.
Yeah.
Now, that's a great sell in recruiting and saying, hey, we got a guy from Belgium. We got a guy from Los Angeles, California. We got a guy from Miami. We got a guy from New York. We got a guy from Seattle, Washington. We got a guy from Austin, Texas. So now you can sell diversity.
Yep.
On your roster. Yep. So not only the education speaks for itself, but then, man, what a locker room you have a chance to have.
It's really
so
cool.
Yeah. All those things, I think, can be advantages at a place like that. Now, you're right. You do have to, it's like going from a ribeye steak to a New York strip. You got to trim the fat in a hurry. But, man, New York strips can be pretty good, too, because those, yeah. Even though there's not a lot of marble and all that stuff. But if you cook it, it's really good. So I think those things can be advantages at a spot like that.
For sure. Yeah, I agree. Well, it helps you narrow your focus for sure.
I remember hearing it was Rose Holman's head coach, a good friend of mine, Nick Sales. We had him on here at one point. And he was talking about now, obviously, Rose Holman and Dartmouth, one's in the Ivy League. I'm not trying to compare the two, but Rose Holman is a engineering school. It's a strong academic background. And they have to specifically tailor the people that they recruit. And I made a comment to him. I was like, so it's probably easier to work with these kids because they probably understand and get what you're putting in front of them, maybe X's and O's, teachings. They learn it and understand it better. He goes, actually, no, it's probably the opposite. He was saying that the guys, since they're more intelligent, they overthink more and they're too smart for it sometimes, that you have to find different and unique ways to teach them. So I thought that was actually pretty interesting.
Definitely think there's some of that. Intelligent guys, yeah, think a lot, can overthink things. I've had pretty good experience in the Ivy League. It's seeing the different types of things. We also have great support here at Dartmouth. One of the things that I was really attracted to is the support staff is as good as anywhere I've ever been with, for example, mental performance coach and leadership. So I think that support that you can get at a place like this and that can support us as coaches is really valuable.
Yeah, no doubt, man. There's just so much there at those kinds of spots that I think, and obviously where you are, Dartmouth's in Maine, correct me if I'm
New Hampshire. New Hampshire.
Oh, it's in New Hampshire, yeah. You're the pro team in town as well.
Yeah, true.
That's right? True. So yes. You not only are you the college team, but you're the pro team. You get that only show type of deal as far as nobody to really compete against. So if you can develop something and it's in those kinds of places, we were just talking about this the other day, what the Thunder have done of connecting their team to the city of Oklahoma City is really special. The documentary called The Oklahoma Standard that's on E60. Outstanding. Tearjerker. Mm. But what a great little place to connect your team to the community as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And letting your guys get involved and throw themselves into your surrounding community right there. You have an intimacy that you can build with your roster and the town.
Yep. Really close. It's a really close knit community here. The community has been awesome. Great place for my family, but the guys know, the administrators, professors, restaurant owners, we have a really cool tight knit community here.
Yeah. Good stuff, man. Get those t-shirts tossed out, man. Keep that t-shirt surplus in your trunk. So you always got them on the ready.
No doubt. Can never have enough of those, honestly.
No, yeah. No doubt, man. Seriously. Yeah. Places like that, towns like that, that goes a long way, man. Yeah. I'm telling you, it goes a long way.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it does. That's something that actually I've seen coaches do before. Just they open up the trunk, pop out a box. There's a couple t-shirts, throw them around. That's great. Mm-hmm. Keeps the community involved.
I'm telling you, man. But no, I did.
But Coach McConnell, first off, we appreciate you for being on here. Obviously, now we selfishly get a chance to be able to watch you, see you guys this next upcoming season. But before we even wrap it up and get to the end, there is one thing that we always like to typically ask at the end, and it's if there's any advice that you have, all the experiences that you have gone through and so on to get you to where you are, any advice that you would give your younger self starting in that first position, what would that advice be?
Man, it's a great question. I thought about a couple of things when you said that. So one is, I remember telling that I don't know if I was associate head coach at Princeton or whatever role I was in, but there was a younger assistant coach who was trying to break into the business. He might've been coaching Division III at the time. And he was like, I'm calling around. I'm asking people, what advice would you have for me? And I said, just be yourself. Just be genuine. And at the time, I could tell he was like, come on. I thought I could get some better advice than that. Years later, he joined our staff at Princeton as an assistant coach. He was like, BMAC, man, I didn't know what you were talking about when you said it then. But now that I've been through it, you're exactly right. Because you get tested, right? You get tested. You also have self-doubt or these sort of fears creep in. And being genuine and being yourself is the only way to do it. But sometimes you're not sure if that can work. And I talked about that earlier. You're wondering, my boss isn't like that. Is that the only way to do it? Can my way work? Can I be myself and be successful? So I'd probably try to give myself some confidence at a young age. Do your thing, be yourself. You'll get there. And then you know what the other thing is? I talk about this with players as well. Some of the best players I've coached that have gone on to the NBA, they got there because they had unbelievable belief that they could get there. And no one else believed, right? Even some of these guys, I thought they were going to be really good college players. But for example, Devin Kennedy, I wasn't sure he was going to be an NBA player, but he never doubted that he was going to get there. And I think in coaching and life professionally, when I got started at Rutgers and then graduated and was like struggling to find a job and became a Division III assistant making $2,000 and working every camp and clinic just to make money, I didn't know where I was going to go. I didn't even think I could get there, let alone be a Division I head coach. And at some point in my career, I got close enough where I was like, you know what? I should pursue this. I should think about this. And so I've learned not to put a ceiling on myself and to have big dreams and big goals. At some point, reality had hit when I was a young coach, and I didn't even think it was possible. And so I would tell myself or other coaches, have big goals and have big dreams. They don't happen overnight, but don't set a bar too low for yourself. Don't cap your ceiling.
No, I love it, man. I love it. We were talking about this a couple of weeks ago on a pod. We have to coach ourselves sometimes the way we coach our players.
100%. Yep. That's a great line. Yeah.
No, we really do. We really do. I'm personally, in full transparency, going through it right now. I go to San Diego thinking it's going to be a 3-4 year experience. And it was a 5.5 month G League stint. And so what do you do when a guy gets to the G League and he gets cut and now he's a free agent? But he knows he's good enough to be in the G League and he knows he's probably good enough to be beyond the G League. But he's cut. Right. So what do we tell those guys? Hey, man, get back to work. Work on your game till the phone rings. Keep putting yourself in places that you want to be. Keep working out against guys that are good enough. You just never know. You're one phone call away. You never know. Yep. So we have to do that to ourselves sometimes the way we coach players. So I'm so glad that you said that because that's something that young coaches definitely need to hear. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
No doubt. No, and especially the advice when you said that be yourself is so basic. But I was the same exact person on the other side of that phone call that you were talking to. And I was like, I've heard this more than enough times. I'm like, there's no way that's just what you have to do. And now being on the other side of it, I've gone through the hiring process. I'm like, wow, this is actually literally it. You just have to be yourself and work hard and things will progress. And you obviously have to, like you said, work hard, be able to do the little things, and you can't just show up and be a good person. You do have to work hard too. But yeah, a lot of things fall together. What's meant to be will be. That's some great advice. That being said, as I mentioned, we really do appreciate you for being on here. Now we have another program to be able to watch and follow along more with. So excited about that one. Be able to check the scores and check some games out next year. So excited for you. Best of luck moving forward. And hopefully after these 6 months, things start to get better for you. Even better.
No, man, that'd be cool. Hey, I appreciate you guys and always happy to do anything for Rising Coaches. Love what you guys do. Love what you're about. And I have not forgotten where I came from in this business and want to support young coaches any way I can. So anybody listening, don't hesitate to reach out. I'd love to help you guys.
No, thank you, man. Be careful what you ask for. We got other things, round tables, other stuff like that. I'll tell you what we may do is obviously between now and then, but we may even get to this point next year and let you do reflections on a first-year awesome. Head coach and what that's, because your growth is just going to skyrocket. You don't even realize it yet, but just what you're going to learn about yourself, much as anything. Yeah. Then you'll be a better basketball coach, X and O wise for sure, but and tactically and all that. But what you'll learn about yourself will be priceless awesome. In the next 12 months, man.
Yeah. So, yeah.
My man, I'm thrilled for you, brother. Appreciate your friendship. It hasn't been long that we've known each other, but it's been real for sure. Appreciate you, man.
Appreciate you guys. All right. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you. And everybody out there, thank you all for tuning in to another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast. Your host, Alan Major, Doug Caputo. Coaches, keep working. Keep rising. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together.
Still hanging on to that old shooting machine that's just sitting in storage and not getting used at all? Our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are here to help trade in your machine. Any make, any model, in any condition, even if it's from a competitor. Plus, you get an extra $250 off the Dr. Dish commercial lineup when you mention Rising Coaches.